I'm Anthony Pastore. Welcome to UBS On Air. COVID-19 has had a major impact on our lives. Stay-at-home orders in many states, schools, restaurants, theaters all closed, hospitals overrun with patients, unemployment on the rise, and this is something that we've experienced across the globe. Today, we will explore the alternative data that my colleagues from the UBS Evidence Lab have been collecting on COVID-19. Today is Tuesday, March 31st, 2020. My guest today is Jeremy Brunelli, Global Head of Frameworks for the UBS Evidence Lab. Jeremy, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast today.
No problem. Pleasure to be here.
So, Jeremy, maybe to start us off, you can let our listeners in on who the Evidence Lab is. What's the team's mission? And, you know, what's the overall framework of what you're trying to accomplish?
So, currently, Evidence Lab is, it's a group of several hundred experts in what's called alternative data. We vary from expertise, people that are software developers to physical scientists, social scientists. We have a PhD in psychology. And these specialties are brought together in an agnostic data way, meaning we're agnostic to the data set. But our mission is really to provide insights and information to decision makers, leveraging what's called alternative data, which can range from anything from like satellite data to data scraped off the internet to weather data. So we're data agnostic. We have a very eclectic group of experts, but the mission is really around providing insights and information to help decision makers.
Great. So I know that you've been dedicating your resources recently to framing coronavirus with data, particularly out of China. Maybe you could give us an overview of the data that you're actually compiling.
Sure. And if you don't mind, I'm going to start with a basic framework of how we've thought about understanding the path, and that helped us to kind of design some of the data set solutions for what we were looking at. So what we try to do first is to provide match economic exposure to the risk of outbreak. So where we saw kind of big outbreaks, how can we define with data sets who's most exposed to those regions? The second thing we tried to do is to understand behavioral changes, whether it's consumer or businesses, as different types of quarantine or containment efforts went into place. The third thing we tried to do is establish high-frequency data sets so that we could, in a sense, trace the profile of the impact, the contraction, the bottom, the recovery of the impact. And then lastly, especially outside of China, but other countries, we try to establish signposts, data sets that can help us look for potential changes in behaviors based on hypotheses that our clients might have around what might happen. So some of the data sets we look at in that framework. So in terms of economic exposure, we collect literally tens of millions of business location data. We clean that data and we're able to then kind of apply it to a region. So, for example, we could look at the distribution and concentration of public restaurant changes in Hubei province, which was where Wuhan is located, ground zero of the outbreak. And as the outbreak continued, depending on which region, then using that data from the health organizations, we could actually quantify the physical location set and the relative exposure to those regions. We also have data where we collect earnings call data, so transcripts from companies, and we use natural language processing. We suck in the data, we process it, and with that data, you can identify themes that either the companies or the investors that are on those calls, what they're talking about. You can also see where they're talking about it. So you can also use that as a way to isolate the economic impact to a region. In the second category, we talked about behavior changes. So when the outbreak happened in China, as obviously we know, people went into lockdown into their homes. So one of the data sets we used to understand how they were behaving behind the scenes was using app usage data. And so app data can be kind of enhanced around kind of certain types of apps. So for example, and this was able to create a profile of spending in a sense. So for example, we could take like 10 different app publishers for telemedicine, 10 different app publishers for, online education and so on and so forth. And so we have different categories like I said, telemedicine, education, music streaming, social media, mobile games, cinema tracking, credit card. And we could see how people were spending their time. So for example, we were seeing a big uptick in people using telemedicine apps. In education apps, we saw a big downtick in people using auto purchase apps, which because people weren't driving. So that was one of the ways we were able to start to profile a behavior change that was happening. Another one, which really gets to social distancing, we collect wait times for every attraction at a global set of parks. So like amusement parks like Disney and Universal. And the idea is the wait time can actually show you or be a proxy for how many people are in the park. If there's more people waiting or longer wait times, therefore there's probably more people. And what we saw in Asia, for example, in like Shanghai Disney and Disney Hong Kong and other APAC-based amusement parks is the wait times year over year were decelerating and actually turned negative ahead of them closing those parks. So we were seeing this data, this social distancing happening even before those companies decided to kind of just shut down because they weren't having traffic to the parks. We could also look at, for example, we scraped web pricing data off of different retailer sites. And there's one data set in particular for that's very seasonal in nature. So retailers buy this seasonal inventory. It's only sold during that season. So if people are not buying it, it's going to sit on the market. So we create these metrics for this, what we call merchandise planning category of apparel, to see how long is it sitting on the market and what is the degree of discounting. And the idea is if it's sitting on the market for a very long time, the retailers oftentimes have to increase the discounting to clear it out because they don't want to have that inventory at the end of the season. So we have global data sets, but also ones that focus just on China, on fashion, apparel, sporting goods, and different things. So again, that's another way to kind of profile behavioral changes. In the third bucket, we look at high-frequency data sets. So one of the ones we got from China was a migration index. So this is daily data that looks at people's movements into a city, out of a city, and within a city. And with that data, we were able to kind of trace the path of the contraction when the shutdowns and the containment went into place into like a mid-February kind of trough where we saw kind of all the declines kind of leveled off. And then subsequently, we saw kind of an improving trend up kind of as those declines got less bad in a sense. And I'd say in the most recent week, the insight that we saw from this data is that recovery trend has actually plateaued. So still better than the bottom, but it's actually still down year over year. So it would suggest the migration trends are not back to where they were a year ago. So they're still down year over year, which might suggest people are kind of still kind of some degree of the population is still not back to normal. We also get global auto congestion data, kind of a similar idea to the migration index, where we kind of see auto movements. And the congestion data, we make it a relative metric to a year-over-year metric to remove seasonality. And we have that for 300 different cities, 30 different countries. And you can use that, again, to trace the path of the contraction, the bottom, and coming out. We also use pollution data. And if you adjust pollution data to remove the impact of weather, the impact of home heating, you can isolate the impact from industry. So what is the pollution contributed to from steel factories, from, paper plants and things like that. So once you've removed the impact from consumers, you can then use that to kind of trace kind of a local measure of economic activity and trace the curve and see how it reacted at the same time as the outbreak of corona. And what we saw, for example, in Hubei was that adjusted pollution index kind of took a statistically significant step down about the same time that the containment efforts kind of went into place. So that's a kind of a several sets of high frequency data sets that we use. And then lastly, we set up signposts. There's different hypotheses around like how behaviors might change. Investors kind of asking us questions about, hey, we think, you know, grocery spending is going to step up in the UK, for example. So we have credit card transaction data for grocery stores in the UK. And while the data is actually not showing kind of, I'd say, an abnormal change in trend, they could use that data as a signpost to watch and test their hypotheses about what's going on. There's similar anecdotal commentary about how heat temperature could, you know, this virus is seasonal, and the temperature, once it gets hot enough, it'll potentially, this virus will kind of go away. There's no evidence of that thus far, and I have no opinion about that. But again, we have a global weather framework, and so if an investor wanted to test that hypothesis, they could leverage this data set, which we update, I think, every 2 weeks, to kind of take a look at that and see which countries have certain thresholds of temperature, which ones are changing and whatnot. So again, we could set up these signposts based on these hypotheses that investors might have about, you know, what's going to happen in the future for coronavirus and its path.
Right. That is an incredible amount of data that you're collecting and compiling, Jeremy. Thanks for giving us that rundown. So given all of that and with all that data, what's the ultimate goal for you and the team? What do you then do with the data?
So we do a lot of, we clean literally like millions of data points every day. And I think, like, going back to our mission, is our goal is really to provide a useful kind of clean set of data that helps decision makers with what they're doing day to day. It's not just investors. We think our applications can be used, our frameworks can be used by a slew of different decision makers, whether they're professionals that work in kind of a corporate, you know, a company that's not doing investments. It could be buy side investors. It could be research analysts and whatnot. But I think really what we want to do, we believe in what's called Bayesian approaches. And what Bayesian basically means, and I'm going to probably butcher it to some degree, it's not about predicting an outcome. It's about increasing or decreasing your confidence around an outcome. So you have a thesis, you have a hypothesis that you want to test, right? And so the alternative data professional who's doing a good job is looking at all data. They're agnostic to the data set, but they're trying to increase or decrease that confidence around that hypothesis. So what we try to do to help that decision maker is create a wealth of different data points around that that either increases their confidence around their hypothesis or kind of decreases it. It doesn't give them the answer per se. It doesn't give you a forecast. We're not in the business for that. But we're just trying to kind of using kind of what would be called alternative data, which is like WebMind data and all these other data sources I mentioned before. It's helped them make better decisions.
That's awesome. And if you dig into the data itself, you mentioned obviously there are tons of analytics that you're looking at. Where does it actually all come from? Because it sounds like they're very into, from my sort of amateur ears on what you're doing, it sounds a little disparate. You know, you've got traffic patterns and app usage and restaurant traffic and weather patterns. Where does it all come from? How do you get the data itself?
So there's I'll repeat the idea of this philosophy of being data agnostic. We, in a very compliant way, we have, I would say, kind of some of the most, and I've worked at startups before, I've worked at other kind of research shops, but we have very strict guidelines around how we get data, how we use it, around kind of GDPR risks, things like that. We have an extensive web mining operation collecting data from the web. We work with hundreds of different external vendors that have data sets. In some cases, it's a paid relation. In some cases, it's like an exclusive and we kind of partner with them. In some cases, we're manually collecting that data. And then I'd say like the most unintuitive or unobvious kind of way, we create a lot of data sets. So we have a technique we call swarming, which it's kind of what I described in terms of creating that mosaic, where we take lots of data sets to apply to an analysis. Sometimes when you start to mash up all those data sets, you can actually create new metrics. So there's a virtuous cycle to this. It's not just like go collect the data, create a metric. We do that literally thousands of times, and then sometimes you start to mash those metrics up, and what we create is what we call a combinatorial asset. where you're combining different kind of elements to create a whole new recipe that can provide value around something. Literally, I'd say hundreds, if not thousands, of different data sources that we're collecting on a weekly basis.
Right. It's a massive amount of information that you're digesting and putting into the compilation of data that you have. Let's take everything that you've given us as far as information about what Evidence Lab is and how you're compiling all this data and practically talk about what's happening right now. So many of us are wondering, obviously the comparisons to China and Europe and in the U.S. Walk us through some of the results of the data that you compiled and maybe give us two or three highlights of something that's jumped out at you and that you want to share with us.
Sure. And I'll speak completely factually about the data without any forward interpretation. So I'd say I think kind of the high frequency data sets is perhaps I think what's resonating a lot right now, because right now people are searching for an anchor. How to explain this, because like the traditional methods don't work. And that's the beauty of alt data. We can create a new base rate anytime, right? So some way to benchmark to. So for example, we have a search monitor for unemployment claims. We launched this last week. And so the data for search interest spiked significantly. I would say like a multi-sigma event type spike in the data. This was ahead of the claims report, which I believe, and I don't remember the data, but I think they reported something like 3 million unemployment claims last week. So that data for the search claims kind of showed a significant spike. So people's interest in kind of exploring around unemployment was an insight we saw. Another one we saw, which I mentioned before, is with the China data. We're starting to see leveling off, and if you pay attention anecdotally to some of the commentary, there's still, I think, a prevailing fear about like a resurgence in kind of an outbreak. And so while China is definitely coming back online, right now the data from at least using just factually the migration data suggests it's not back to where it was year over year. It's still down, and I'd say in some cases significantly down year over year. It's improved certainly from the bottom of that curve we described, but it's still down. And I think, another interesting, not interesting, but another factual insight we saw was in the Corona search data set. We saw, for example, in Hong Kong, the initial kind of early spike in interest, and then it spiked and it went down. And recently it started to kind of climb again. And this was ahead of what we saw recent news where they've kind of locked down parts of Hong Kong again. We also saw a similar trend in Singapore with this data set ahead of, again, recent kind of activities by the government to kind of lock down again because there's been an outbreak, a resurgence in a sense. So these are several kind of, I would say, kind of real data points using the alternative data that were kind of insightful to us, kind of recent trends.
That's excellent. Thanks, Jeremy. Really helpful. So can you actually use this data from China as an analog for the U.S. and compare those similarities?
I think I wouldn't go as far as to say you could create a prediction model per se. I'm not an epidemiologist. I'll let the scientists do that work. There are so many, I think, nuances and characteristics that are different about what's happening in China in terms of the relative kind of reaction, the demographics of the country, the road networks or the transportation networks that connect people. So I think there are some probably common things that you can expect and you can use. And so what I'd say to people is we have thousands of data sets, and what I tell people to do is to use that framework that we did. And we've done this for every country. We did it for China to start. And then we started to do it for Europe and we started to do it for the US. Start by using some of the data sets that give you a sense of who's exposed to a region. Secondly, start to use some of the data sets that can help you identify shifts in behavior. The shifts in behavior are not necessarily going to be the same in China versus the US, but those same frameworks that we use for China could be leveraged, I think, to kind of identify those shifts in behavior. You might see something completely different, but you could still use that app framework, for example, to kind of define it. Then try to figure out some high frequency data sets. Again, same frameworks can help you with this. movements of people. The pollution data I talked about, we've used that both to kind of identify impacts from Corona, but also we've seen we could use that kind of that data set adjusted for the financial crisis in Michigan. We saw unemployment spike, and we saw the adjusted pollution index kind of trough during the same time. So you can identify similar frameworks to apply, but I think the profile of the curve will probably be a little bit different. The behavior changes will be a little different. There's different aspects. I wouldn't say it's one-to-one, but definitely you could leverage some of that same kind of analytical framework that cadence I mentioned as a way to look at it.
Right. Excellent. Well, this is a great conversation. I'm so glad we're actually having an opportunity to chat here, Jeremy, because I think what you all are doing is really incredible, and the amount of data that you're compiling and is massive. So, obviously, and I'd love to continue these conversations with you, because this particular situation that we're in with the pandemic will be going on for weeks and weeks, and I'm sure that you've got more data that you're looking to compile. So that takes me to my final question for you is, what does the future data look like then, Jeremy? Do you look at the same data every week to compare to see how things are changing? Do you pull up new data as it comes your way? How does that work for you?
Yeah, so I can't speak in detail about specifics that we're launching, but what I'll tell you is we have a culture around innovation, and especially right now, a focus on providing insight and information around what's going on. So in the past couple weeks, we've launched, I want to say, upwards of 10 new frameworks. So we're multiple frameworks every week that we've never launched before that are focused on helping. And I'd say there's the high frequency data sets are especially useful for people, because again, people are trying to find that base rate. And so we're trying to find different data sets that provide them that base rate to understand kind of the path and where we are in the path, and whether we're recovering or whether we're troughing and different things like that. And then I say theoretically long term, there are going to be potential structural changes to behavior. And so we're also thinking about what data sets can we be kind of two chess moves ahead to help measure what happens. I'll talk to you just from my own personal self, not about any project that we're doing. My wife and I are talking about homeschooling our kids next year, because, even if the virus kind of gets better situation in the U.S., we could still be in a situation where it's still out there. And so I believe there's probably a lot of conversations that are happening. So again, we're also thinking about data sets to be a little bit kind of ahead of the curve a few months out. So we're starting to collect data around that as well.
That's terrific. Jeremy, thank you so much. I hope to continue these conversations with you over the coming weeks, and hopefully you're staying safe, and sounds like you're home as well, since you're homeschooling the kids already. Stay safe and well out there, Jeremy. Thanks very much for joining me today.
Anthony, it was really a pleasure, and I hope you'll have me back. Thank you so much.
I'd love to do that, because I know there's a ton of data that you're collecting, and I'd love to be able to share that with our audience. Jeremy Brunelli, Global Head of Frameworks for the UBS Evidence Lab. Jeremy, thanks very much. Thanks for joining us, everybody. From New York City, I'm Anthony Pastore. Have a great day.
This presentation is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. Neither UBS Financial Services, Inc. nor any of its employees provide tax or legal advice. You should consult with your personal tax or legal advisor regarding your personal circumstances. In providing wealth management services to clients, we offer both investment advisory and brokerage services, which are separate and distinct and differ in material ways. For information, including the different laws and contracts that govern, visit ubs.com/workingwithus. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG, member FINRA, SIPC.